Hello and welcome to another episode of Dice Exploder. Each week we take a tabletop RPG mechanic and explode it. We explode the hell out of it. My name is Sam Dunnewald, and now that the kickstarted portion of Season 3 is finally over, today, I've got a treat for you. The backers-only episode from that campaign. You didn't think I was going to just hold on to an episode this good forever, did you? It's the show's namesake mechanic, Exploding Dice! Ugh. My co-host for this one is Mikey Ham, designer of the award-winning Slug Blaster, all-around good dude and enthusiastic nerd. He's got a new game on Kickstarter right now, Two Hand Path, a solo game roll-and-write dungeon crawler. Draw power-ups right onto your mage's hands as cool tattoos and rings and shit. It's great, back it now. Anyway, Mikey's a goof, Slug Blaster's a goof, and I thought he'd be great for what I thought was going to be a goofy episode on Exploding Dice. But this turned out to be a much more in-depth conversation than I had devil's bargained for, because while Exploding Dice might be a silly and flamboyant mechanic, the sheer number of games that use it and the many different variations on it brought out a lot of opinions in both of us about how mechanics are like tools and how designers can deploy them with intention and how goofy excitement is just as important a tool as quote-unquote sensibility. But before we dive into all of that, I wanted to say this too. Mikey and I talk a lot in this episode about how we think people should be going about designing the best games that they can. But I hope it's clear how much both of us believe that fundamentally, the thing every designer should be doing is whatever makes them happy. If listening to us is helpful, hell yeah, I'm so happy to hear it. If we're wrong about any of this for you, good. Who says we have any idea what we're talking about? And on that note, here is Mikey Ham with Exploding Dice.
Let's talk about some dice.
Mikey, thanks for being here. It's the first ever bonus episode of Dice Exploder. We're talking about exploding dice. Obviously, what else could we talk about? It has to be this.
Yep.
What are exploding dice? Tell me about it.
Yeah, exploding dice. Well, I a lot of times people in rule books also call it open-ended, which just isn't as exciting of a word, but I think it kind of conveys it a little bit, maybe more clearly. But yeah, if you roll usually like the highest result on a dice, I always think of a D6. That's what pops in my mind. Yeah. You roll a six, you get to roll it again and add the result, and you can keep going forever.
Yeah. You can roll infinitely high. You could roll a 666 if the devil is really in your dice for the day, you know?
That's right. Yeah.
There's no upper limit. And this mechanic is way too big to be in a single game, right? Like, I don't know how. Look, we're going to talk about how. Like, this mechanic is in, you came up with this list of like 12 different games, and I'm sure it's in tons of others too. It's everywhere.
Yeah, and I don't think of myself as a well-researched game scholar either. So a lot of games use it, especially like in different, I think we'll talk about this, but different types of games and eras of games used it, right? So
yeah, the shocking thing to me was I remember first encountering Exploding Dice in Shadowrun 2nd Edition when I was like 12 years old and my dad bought me that game from a used bookstore. It was like highlighted all over the place. I'm sure my dad did not understand the content that was in this game. And Exploding Dice were in there, and I was like, that's pretty cool. And my recollection was that it was very much something of that like 90s, early aughts era of game design. And then you come in with this list, and it's like kids on bikes. Like, that's a recent
new stuff,
game. Like, people are still using this stupid mechanic. It's so weird and bad. I don't know what to...
Well, like, we might as well underline the premise of this episode is probably going to be me defending Exploding Dice against your sort of like general dislike of them.
We could just do the poll quote up top, right? Like, the poll quote from this episode is me saying, why would you do this? And you saying, bro, it's cool. You're overthinking
it's fun.
It just fucking rips.
Like, it's not
Exploding
that deep,
Dice
you know?
Rule. It's called, the reason it's in every fucking game is because it's called Exploding Dice.
Yes.
Do you not need Exploding Dice in your game? Because I sure as shit do. Like, let's explode them. It's the podcast name. Let's do it.
I do think that that's why this is one of the mechanics that people know about and, you know, the mechanic that led to the name of the podcast. It's just not very many mechanics have a name, at least like not a commonly sort of understood one. And most of them aren't nearly as cool as exploding dice. So, you know, because people say, like, you know, you have a roll under mechanic, you know, like things that kind of describe a mechanic well, I guess, but aren't that exciting. And then there are tons of mechanics that, like, don't really have a name. Like, is there a name for, like, the Blades in the Dark result spread? Probably not. It may be just Blades in the Dark result spread, right? But, like,
And then you have Devil's Bargains inside Blades. Sure. That's kind of like a cool name for it. But everyone runs out there and renames that and all their hacks to be more flavorful because it doesn't fit every game, you know?
Yeah.
Like, people are constantly doing that. Whereas Exploding Dice, like, you're absolutely fucking right. It's called Exploding Dice. Like, who's renaming it?
Yeah.
Only losers.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's the thing. Like, I mean, I'm sure that there are nerds nerdier than us who know like names of lots of different mechanics. I think you can even go on like Board Game Geek and like search by mechanic and stuff.
Oh, sure.
In the board game realm, but I don't
worker
know how
placement.
Much that, stuff like that. So yeah, trick taking and all that stuff. So
Exploding Dice is unmatched in naming. There's
100%.
Nothing else like it. Is
yeah,
the point.
No, exactly. So
okay, so I'm going to walk us through some examples first, and I'm going to walk us through examples from stupidest to least stupid, okay?
Okay.
So I think the absolute worst version of this mechanic is Shadowrun 2nd Edition. So,
and I'm going to let you take this one because I've never played it and barely read it. So I'm not going to argue with you on this one at all.
So imagine a dice pool, you're putting it together, and we're going to take exploding dice out of it for a second. The way dice pools work in this game is you get yourself like 8 dice in your hands or whatever. You have a couple of numbers that add together to get the number of dice you're going to roll. The GM sets a number that you need to get on an individual die to get a hit. And then the number of hits that you get total, so the number of dice above whatever the difficulty threshold is, that's your, like, successes for the roll. And then you can spend successes to do stuff, maybe.
Yeah.
So
that's pretty meaty.
So exploding dice, first of all, there's already too many numbers going around here.
Yeah.
Second of all, exploding dice do not get you additional successes. The way exploding dice work here is that the GM can just say, actually, on this roll, the target number is a 9. And so to get a 9, to get a single success, you have to roll a 6 on your die and then re-roll it and add 3. And I don't understand why you would do this. Like, why not just raise the number of successes that you need? Why not have exploding dice like count as additional successes as opposed to like raising the number on the one die? There's so many other ways you could do this to make it less confusing, and they've chosen none of them.
I feel like counting successes is kind of new.
That's
like,
that is true.
I think that's like a newer thing, like the D6 die pool with where you count your successes. I think that's newer. Like Shadowrun is still in the where it's all about beating like a DC or a target number, right? So yeah, it's kind of in this weird place where it combines a dice pool with that.
Yeah.
So, but I agree in that, like, that works if your target numbers are going to be like, you know, 7, 8, or maybe 9 for something really hard and you want to portray that. But
yeah,
you know, I think in the example text I'm reading, they talk about like target numbers of 14 and like they put in parentheses like really hard, and it's like hard, like
it's like a less than 1 in 36 chance. Like, why are you rolling dice in the first place? And also, we gotta back up because you said target numbers 7, 8, and 9, and target number 7 is irrelevant. Target number 7 is not a real target number, because anytime you roll a 6 and explode it, like, anytime you're rolling a 6, it automatically explodes, which means you actually never can get a 6. You go straight from 5 to 7. It doesn't make any sense. It's just bad.
That's one of the things that doesn't make sense if you open the hood, and you have to be careful of it if you're a GM or a game designer, like, hacking the game. I'm not sure if that oddity presents it in play, because...
Yeah.
You know, it's kind of one of those things where it's like, I mean, I didn't think of it. You're the one who showed me. Like, a player might not think of, like, oh, yeah, I guess I'll never roll a 6 or a 7. But a GM certainly has to be aware of that, right? Like,
well, a GM is not going to be aware of that, I think, a lot of the time. I certainly wasn't when I was 12 and running this game, you know? Like, I think when you're dealing with the probabilities... To come around to your side for a second, I think when you're dealing with the probabilities of exploding dice that are already kind of at the tail of the bell curve in that fringe area, like, what does it really matter? Like, that you need an 8 or a 9 on a single D6? Like, okay, you need a high. It's unlikely. It's just really unlikely. It doesn't really matter whether it's a 3% or a 4%, right?
Yeah, I don't find it appealing in a case where, like, if there's some specific action you're going to do and the GM says, okay, well, you can try it, but you'd have to roll this crazy thing to do it. That's not as fun to me. There are some uses of exploding dice, and this will be sort of one of my arguments for why exploding dice are fun. And I don't think it applies to the Shadowrun example, but it will apply to other examples we'll look at later, is that even if something is extremely unlikely, just knowing that there's the possibility of it makes the role more exciting. This is the same reason that people buy lottery tickets, right? Yeah. Everyone knows that there's virtually no chance, but even a very logical person buying a lottery ticket will feel a bit of a dopamine rush when they scratch it, right? And I know, I mean, since we're talking about old games that use this, I'll talk about Rolemaster and Middle Earth Roleplaying, which I've only played once, but my gaming group that I play with regularly, you know, they're older than me, and that's what they all started. And in that, it's a percentile system. And if you roll 95 or higher, it's open-ended. It explodes, right? And so, you know, it's the kind of thing where it doesn't happen often, but it definitely happens at least once or twice a session with the amount of rolls all the players are doing. And those moments are often pretty memorable.
Yeah.
And they have, like, MERP uses, like, all these tables for, like, every single thing. But the tables have really fun and kind of funny stuff, especially the further above 100 you get, like 117 to 119. While daydreaming, you put your hand in front of your bolt while firing, lose a finger. You know, like, so it has fun stuff. So, like, it's exciting when someone gets that open-ended thing. Yeah. And it's every role is exciting because you know that that stuff has happened. Now, obviously, this is trad stuff. This is not storytelling gaming where, you know, modern story gaming, we want to emulate, like, very tight, often formulaic narratives, like movies and stuff. That's what the games are built to do. This isn't going to do that. This is going to be, like, you know, classic trad game silliness where your main character can die on his first roll, which is exactly what happened the one time I've played Middle Earth Roleplaying. I had this badass half-orc guy with, like, two, we were playing kind of a Middle Earth, like, Western setting. I had, like, two guns, and I didn't know anything about Rolemaster and how gritty and brutal it is. And I was, like, much more cinematic in the way I played. And so I jumped up on, I said, like, I jump up on the tables and I fire, and the GM rolls a bunch of dice, and I got, like, I exploded something and got my head blown right off. Like,
you got your head one, is what got exploded.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. First thing. And of course it was, like, so shocking and, like, deflating for me in the moment, especially as a younger gamer, and especially because with MERP character creation takes, like, 3 hours. So it's, like, extra brutal. But it is true that, like, that moment became legend at our table, and, like, we talk about it, you know? So I think sometimes those exciting rant, like, the more unlikely something is, and you and your gaming group are playing a campaign in a single game for, you know, a year or two, which, again, is more common with these trad games, those kind of crazy moments are going to happen sometimes. Yeah. And so I think it makes sense under that lens, but not in Shadowrun, at least.
Yeah.
Well, at least what I'm reading here, that you're right. That seems so wonky, but...
Yeah, Shadowrun is just incredibly wonky. I did want to underline, though, like, the point that you're making about, like, weird stuff at the edge of the bell curve is fun is something that I talked a lot about in Season 2 on an episode with Chris Greenbrier about Blazeball. We talked about in that how Blazeball was a game built entirely on generating weird bell curve tale stuff and enjoying it. And Chris brought up the example of how in this game, The Great Soul Train Robbery, there's this chance that if you roll three dice and all of them come up sixes, then the devil appears.
Yes.
And it's just, it doesn't matter. Like, you know, it's one in 1,024 chance or something that the devil just like shows up on his train and like fucks you up or whatever. But like the fact that it's in the rules that the devil can just show up, it fucking rules.
Oh, 100%.
Like, that's exploding dice.
Yeah. Man. Yeah, exactly. And just having it there. Yeah, it just, it, there's this crackling possibility, and it just like, it, and it tells a lot about the world. And, you know, it's kind of like how you can, in some games, you can have a table that is completely unnecessary, but it says something about the world, right? Like,
totally.
No, I love that kind of stuff. And, you know, and if that ever happens, you know, it's, people will talk about it forever. And it, you know, it probably takes up one little sidebar box worth of space. So it's not, I think that kind of use of that kind of stuff can totally be cool depending on the kind of game you're making.
Hi, I'm Maia, and this is Maia's Game Room, a narrative actual play anthology featuring short-form, story-driven TTRPGs. Each season tells a new story using a different rules-light system brought to life with sound design, editing, and emotional-rich roleplay. So, if you love cinematic storytelling and character-driven drama, come check out Season 1, set in the haunting world of the Electric State RPG. Just search Maia's Game Room wherever you get your podcasts.
So let's push through a couple other examples here. So Earthdawn and Seventh Sea have a pretty similar version where essentially you're rolling a dice pool, and then you're in Seventh Sea, you're keeping like the highest couple, and Earthdawn, you're just like rolling two and adding them up. But dice explode. So, you know, you're generally shooting for target numbers that are like in the teens, sort of like standard D&D D20 kind of target number ranges, but you have the capability of getting up to 25, 30, 35 because you're rolling a bunch of dice and they can explode, which is cool. Great.
Sure.
You know, I think really my knee-jerk reaction to exploding dice are bad was just remembering Shadowrun second edition.
For sure.
But like Earthdawn, go for it.
Yeah, no, and a lot of this comes down also to how much people like doing math, right? Like some people have no problem, like they find adding up a bunch of dice results fun, right? And other people, that's just like in the way, and if there's a way to design that out of a game, that's good, right? But I agree, like I think it's always better in a situation where you're not trying to hit a specific target number. It's more like if your dice explode, you get bonus fun cool things. Or, you know, if it's just like a damage, you know, it's always fun to get like more damage. But I always think that's better than a situation where it's like, oh, like we need this dice to explode. Like,
yes,
I don't know.
Totally.
Because that's so rare, right?
Exploding dice as like sprinkles on top of the ice cream, as opposed to like a, like you don't want to just sit there and spoon sprinkles into your mouth. Like,
I don't think you want to make it, but you don't want to make it like a load bearing mechanic. I don't think.
Yeah.
Like, I don't know. I mean, maybe someone will crack it and find a, like a way. But that, to me, all the best examples I see, because, you know, I think it's like a fun, silly mechanic. So it seems like it would be hard to make it like a mechanic that really does its work, right? All the examples we're going to talk about, the ones that work are, where it's like extra bonus stuff or like some sort of fun extra. But
so I think Burning Wheel has the best example of like exploding dice as just a workhorse mechanic where dice explode, but you don't add them together. You just count additional successes.
That's
so, you know, you've got a pool, you need like three successes on the roll or whatever. And like, if you need fours and you roll 6, 3, 3, 2, then you roll another six, then you roll a four. You got three successes off of the one die, and that's sweet. And I think this reduces the overall variance because you're not like adding to the total of a single die. You don't have to like keep track of all that stuff. Like all that just goes away. It's just like, no, simple successes. And you're already sort of operating on a level of like 1 to 3, 4, 5 successes. And one additional success off an exploded die like matters there quite a bit.
Yeah.
And also doesn't push you into the range of like rolling a 14 on a D6, right? You're still keeping the bell curve somewhat contained. So you get a lot of the fun of exploding dice still while keeping the thing reasonable.
Yeah, I agree. I found this paragraph that you sent me where they explain, it felt a little like thick and unwieldy when I was reading it. But then I took some dice and I like just tried it, and it's super intuitive in play, right? Like, which a lot of dice pool mechanics are, right? I actually, like, you know, I made a dice pool game, and so, you know, but I feel like I have complicated feelings about it, only in that I think sometimes, I think it's maybe in the story gaming scene, like, I think we, you know, rolling a die and adding a modifier and trying to beat a target number is seen as very trad, and we all got really excited about dice pools, and I think dice pools are really cool, and like, especially for different kinds of games and stuff, but it is funny to me, I see people designing a game with a dice pool, and they're very proud that they don't have to do, like, they're not doing math like the way a trad thing is, but really, it's actually so much to keep track of, and you're still counting up a lot of things, and you're upgrading your success levels, and you're doing all this stuff. And sometimes I'm like, man, you know, like, I don't know, adding 7 to 8 is not that hard. You know, like a D&D skill check is unequivocally like quicker than a Blades in the Dark roll. Now, Blades in the Dark roll accomplishes a lot more, but I think sometimes we can get almost like tribal with mechanics, right? And I think that I like to, I don't know, my philosophy is to stay like open-minded and curious and think of mechanics as like value neutral.
Yeah.
Because I feel like you never know when something's going to like be the right tool for the job. But, and I think there's a whole movement now, this sort of post-trad thing where people who like excited about story games and now are looking back and being like, man, there are some things I miss about my trad games. I wonder if I can like apply some of this and fix that, right? And and I find that stuff exciting. Maybe that's the place I'm in right now, but a lot of game designers, you know, we want to challenge ourselves and go on to the new thing. And I think it makes sense that after I've spent quite a few years working in like a very story game space, now I'm like, okay, like what else? Like, let's try this and this. And I think maybe it's just my friends who are sort of in similar places. I just see a lot of them trying some of this, you know, like post-trad tactical stuff, or they're going even further and like going into different directions, right? And that's cool. That's the way it should be. Like, we should always keep moving in different directions and circling back. And it's neat.
Yeah, I'm out here like sending M a list of NSR, OSR games and modules that I want to run, and then also signing up to run a bunch of LARPs at Big Bad Con. So
and then you got like me and Cass Ray Nevin, as he's online. Like, we're working on something that's like tactical, a little more board gamey, even.
Yeah,
like, you know, we're trying different stuff, and then there are people in our community who I feel like are still on the path of like trying to just make the purest story experience they can. And I think that's cool too. I just don't think it's the only path, but, and the only way to have fun, but it is like, I find it so cool just to like, and you know, you can boil something down. You're super good at that, at just like, how can I make like the cleanest thing? And I think that's admirable too.
That is certainly my want.
Yeah.
I think a lot of the people listening to this show who found this show so far are really coming out of that like Forged in the Dark story game space.
Yeah,
I'm curious if you can just speak a little bit in more detail to what you see as like the signs that a Forged in the Dark style dice pool is not the right fit for a game that are coming out of that community.
Yeah, that's a good question. I think what you got to do is you got to play test and record a play test and take a section where someone does a roll and just see how long it took, and then see what the results were and if the result was worth it. You know, like, now there's so much play culture stuff too, because I know a lot of people have said that one of the ways people sort of quote unquote play Blades wrong and maybe aren't enjoying it as much as they could is that they're rolling too often. They're used to games where you roll more often. And that's probably my experience too. That's why I think when I ran Blades with my group, we started like sort of cutting corners off of the roll and not worrying about position effect too much, or at least shooting from the hip on it and not consulting the tables or anything. Although I feel like that's, again, that's a beginner thing anyways. That's when you're learning, you're going back to the tables and stuff. But I think
position and effect, the whole point of it is to be training wheels for you to just like have a conversation about the fictional positioning of the roll at the table.
Totally.
Right?
Totally. But but I noticed in my group, we just like rolling dice, I think. And I think we're just also are that's sort of the rhythm that's been hardwired into us from playing D&D so much. And I mean, there might be something to be said for like games that try to challenge and rewrite those habits in a group. But I think there's also sort of a sophisticated design style where you try to design a game that works with a table's habits. So if you sort of know your audience and what games they're coming from, you can kind of like try to find the places where like, if it ain't broke, don't fix it. Right. So, and so for my group, we were rolling a lot more. And so when I made Slug Blaster, I tried to make it so you can roll quite a bit. Yeah. And I tried to keep that roll pretty quick, and you have great intentions, and then you have to add some other cool thing. And there are definitely ways in Slug Blaster to have a pretty complicated roll. But I think in general, I succeeded in making it a little more sort of poppy and streamlined in that way.
I would agree.
But yeah, I think like, man, I'd encourage people to like take a look at their game and what they want, and just for fun, like try playing it with like, I don't know, like a D20, like just see what happens and compare it. Cause you might be like, you might be sick to your stomach when you find that it works pretty well like that, which means that maybe a dice pool isn't even the best thing, or maybe you have to sort of restructure the dice pool like conversation or something. But, and you don't have to even play test with a group. You can just like, you can play test by yourself. Just try jumping over a chasm and attacking an orc in your game, and then do it in D&D and just see like how much more are you accomplishing. And if the answer is a lot more, then yeah, keep it going, right? Yeah. But I think sometimes we can kind of Rube Goldberg this thing a little too much, just in our attempt to use fun new tools like dice pools, right? That was me. I was just like, a dice pool is cool. I've never played a game with this before. And so
you
want to use it, right?
Yeah.
Or you feel like, you know, you like a lot of things about Blades in the Dark that seem to line up with what you're making. But I think a lot of us realized that like what might look like a perfect fit at the beginning, you quickly realize like Blades in the Dark is pretty like bespoke system for that specific story. And like you change one thing and the whole thing can come apart. So
people do not fuck around with the fundamentals of that system when they try to hack it nearly as much as they should. Like, I really think, listen, this is behind a paywall now. I can get spicier than normal. Like, if you aren't ripping the absolute guts out of a system when you are hacking it, like I imagine you will make something that is perfectly fine, maybe even good, but like, you probably are not making the best thing for what you want to do, because I really think every system that is functioning at a super high level is extremely bespoke to the story that it's telling.
Or you have to go the other way and you have to make sure that the game you want to make is like a one for one reskin of what Blades in the Dark is, right? Like, I think that is my advice to people who want to hack Blades in the Dark.
I thought you were going to come in here and defend generic games for a second.
No.
I'm glad you didn't do that. All right.
Come back in. No, I think you have to. No. I mean, should I? No. I think, yeah. Like, I think when people talk about hacking Blades in the Dark, I want to just be like, make sure your game is about a group of criminals doing crime in an isolated area that has a supernatural component, and then you're okay, you know, like,
yeah,
but like, then you can basically just do like an actual like hack, or like, you know, not like what a lot of us ended up doing, which was like just making new games that like use pieces, which is awesome too, but it just takes a long time. Right. And sometimes you can get a sense that a person they're not in it to spend 2 years making something. They're just like, oh, can I hack this to do superheroes? And you're like, you can, but you're probably going to realize that either it's not going to work quite right, or you're going to have to spend 2 years reworking things, right? Like,
the best way to get to your superhero hack of Blades is to play Blades for 2 years with your home game, and then be like, do you want to just run this with superheroes instead, and like hack it on the fly with your home game, and like leave it on the table.
Right. You've sort of been doing some stuff like that too, right? Of just like really freeform game creation.
Bring the tools, like real time
game creation.
You were about to spin off into another point.
Oh, no, I was just going to say, like, I think you could totally make a Blades in the Dark hack in under a month if you stuck to that formula and just, you know, like, I'm going to do Blades, but in 1975, I'm going to do Blades, but in...
Prohibition era, and there's ghosts. We fucking nailed it, right?
Yeah, exactly. But it's otherwise, I agree with you. It's like, don't just use a mechanic because you like it or because the other games you like are using it or the culture of the scene you're in likes it. That might not be the best mechanic for your game. You know, mechanics, they become, in some scenes, they're almost seen like, it's almost like there's so much dogma around them that it's almost like certain mechanics are inherently good or evil. But I don't think that's the way new designers especially should feel about things. Like, they should feel open to throwing things out or trying something else. Or exploding dice might be a great example. That's like a thing that is so fun and is so appealing, especially to certain kinds of new game designers like me.
Yeah.
That you I can imagine so many people want to crowbar it into their games.
Well, I think this is actually a great segue into the last example I wanted to talk about, which is the Deep Apiarist is a playbook or a class in Heart, the City Beneath.
Oh, okay. Yeah. And this is a game you have a fraught relationship with, right?
I need to do that episode because I'm not going to do fucking 2 hours about Heart right now. But yes, it is true that I have a fraught relationship with Heart. But Heart at large does not have exploding dice. But yes, the Deep Apiarist is the bee man or woman or person or whatever sort of nibbling gender you want to have. I once played a game of Space Post where there was a character who was a bee that we decided had the pronouns bee bim. And I will ride that joke until I die. So this is a game that its core dice mechanic is pretty similar to Blades in the Dark. It has a full success, partial success, and a failure. And it's using D10s instead of D6s. Yeah. So, you know, a full 10 is like a success. I think like a 6 to 9 or something is a partial success. Whatever. It doesn't matter. The Deep Apiarist is the bee person. They're like gradually becoming made of bees. And they have an ability, Sacred Geometry, that says when you roll a 6 on any D10, then you add an additional D6 to the die. So we're back to adding the explosion onto a single die roll, but the second die can't explode. And there is a real reason for this to exist because 6 is the number of the hexagon. Hashtag go check out the episode I did with Clayton all about hexagons.
Yep.
but it's a number sacred to the bee people because it's the hexagon number.
Yeah.
And so this is an ability that's just like sixes are better. Like when you roll a 6, you roll a D6 and you add it to the result. And it's not pushing out the extension of the bell curve either as much, right? It's taking a little bit of a partial success amount and moving it up towards the full success, essentially. So like it scooches the middle of the bell curve over a little bit, but it still has that feeling of like, aha, sometimes I get to roll an extra die. Isn't that kind of cool and fun? So you like get the fun of exploding dice. You get the like flavor reason for this mattering and you get not weird probability stuff. It's just a home run ability for me. Like, this is how you should be using every ability. Like, this is, goes back to everything we were saying about Blades in the Dark hacks, right? Like, anything you are keeping from any game, any mechanic in any game, even if it's not a hack, should be there for a reason. It should be there because it is supporting something cool in the game that you're making. And this is supporting the lore of the bee dudes, the lore of the bee nibblings. Like, rules. It fucking rules.
Yeah, absolutely. It's just, exactly. It's just like a fun little thing where, I love that. Especially when it's like a number that doesn't make sense, like in the math of it. It's just a random number in the spread, but that number is significant. That's just awesome. I'll talk about another game, one other one. This is Renegade Racers by Keegan X. And it's just like a Fast and the Furious type game.
Yeah, sure.
In fact, you have two approaches. You can go be fast or you can be furious. That's like your two skills, basically.
Yeah.
But they use an exploding thing for your stunts. And it's funny. They use a D4. So that's something we didn't really talk about that much. But if you use different die sizes for exploding, it can change things wildly, right? Like, and so they use a D4. So, and it's kind of more your count successes thing too, because it's, you know, if you end up rolling a 4, one time you get a basic stunt. If you do two times, you get a character stunt, which is like a special stunt that your character has. or two basic stunts. And if you roll four three times, you get to do a montage, a stunt montage, you know, and that's, it's not a great chance that that will happen, but it's, again, it's enough that it's the kind of thing that's probably going to happen in a campaign to at least
it's
one of the players.
It's not one in 1,024.
Yeah,
it's one
exactly.
in 64. Like,
yeah. And just having it there, like, who doesn't want to know they have the possibility of getting to do like a stunt montage, right? So totally. I think that's cool. And I haven't read the full game like super well yet, so those odds might even be different. There might be some other element I'm forgetting to incorporate in. But anyways, I think especially, man, exploding dice seems to really fit well with magic things, damage things, like anything chaotic and sort of cool extra things like stunts and stuff like that. And like, as soon as I saw this, I was like, that makes so much sense, because I guarantee if I'd been able to find a way, I would have put exploding dice into Slug Blaster in like the tricks mechanic, right? Like,
yeah,
it just, yeah, that's where it seems to want to live, is in that kind of, this is here for fun extra stuff, not to determine if your character has the strength to lift this gate. It's for the extra, I don't know, it just seems like it fits well in there. I think there's a D&D spell that explodes. Oh yeah, Chaos Bolt, right? Like the Sorcerer's Chaos Bolt, and that's a perfect place for it, right? Like,
yeah,
that lottery ticket thing of like, I can cast a spell, it's not as good as casting Magic Missile, but Magic Missile doesn't have the chance of killing every skeleton in this place. And
well, a damage, you know, is a great place to put it, because like, it's actually pretty cool if we just like end the combat right now, because then we don't have to be in combat anymore. Like, you know, like the consequences for exploding like really too far kind of don't exist in the best places for this. Like, if you just like do the thing like super well, like that rules.
Yeah, exactly.
I really do like my metaphor of sprinkles on the ice cream is like what exploding dice feels like to me. You know, the idea that like magic is going to explode and other dice rolls aren't is really, it like doesn't really change the math of your game very much or your whatever's going on, but it does make magic feel a little special, right?
Yeah.
It's kind of cool.
Absolutely. Yeah, exactly. I think that's it. If you have a, you know, Robin Laws in one of his podcast episodes, he talked about when to make a mechanic humble. And it's this like thing of like, you have all these mechanics in your game, or, you know, all these pieces in your game at least, and they can't all be noisy and be asking for attention, right?
Yes.
Sometimes you just need some simple mechanic that gets someone through the you know, a shoe leather mechanic, right? That just like gets you from one place to another so that you can then spend more time with whatever your game is supposed to be focusing on, right?
Yeah, Mark Rosewater, the head designer of Magic, calls this a complexity budget. That if you're over
budget,
people are just going to be overwhelmed and they're not going to play your game. They're going to lose what's going on.
Yeah.
But if you're under budget, then when you put the complexity in the place that's fun, so people will go engage with it.
Exactly. So, you know, he talks about like, yeah, sometimes you want to just go simpler and, you know, you don't have to impress your game designer friends with every rule in your book, right?
Yeah.
And in fact, that's going to not work, right? But then the next episode, they return to it and say, okay, now we're going to talk about like, what if you've made your mechanic too humble and you want to unhumble it a bit?
Yeah.
And they talk about, you know, ways to expand or dig deeper or, you know, or jazz it up. And I think this is a great example of something that you could just, yeah, like you said, sprinkle on something that you want to add a little more pizzazz to or highlight a little bit more. You know, I know when I was designing Slug Blaster, I had moments like that where I was like, I looked at the book and just sort of like how much time I was devoting to each part. And I'd realize like, man, the real estate I'm allotting here doesn't map to what I want the game to be about. Mm-hmm. So I'd have to go in and shift things and cut things, but also expand certain things. Be like, okay, I really wanted this game to be, have a lot of chases in it. So I have to take this chase mechanic and change it from one column to a full page or whatever. And just kind of like, you know, even if it's just providing more examples, but it gives a visual cue, it just adds some weight where people go, oh, okay, he's saying that chases are important in this game, right? So,
yeah. All right. So we talked a minute in there about kind of the math of exploding dice on how smaller dice explode more often. And that's kind of interesting.
Yeah.
I went and found a link to this in the show notes, but someone has a chart with all the math on this. And I was really hoping that like an exploding D4 would actually have a higher expected value than like a regular D6, but is unfortunately not the case. It turns out you have to get all the way down to D2s, otherwise known as coins, which actually do explode to a higher value than D3s, even exploding D3s. I thought that was
funny.
But you know, it's coins for you. But
and I haven't made a coin that's fun to roll, or at least not commonplace. I did play with this one board game. They had these little runes, and they were perfectly made. They were like a D2 in a sense, but they were just beveled and like curved enough that you could scoop them up off the table really easily and into your hand like dice, and then they fell really nice. And I was just like, I need these to become popular because I want to use D2s in my games. And same with D3s. I'm like, I need like a D6, but labeled as a D3.
Yeah.
I need that to be in every polyhedral set so that I can use D3s in more of my games, because like, especially story gamers, all we want are three results, you know, so it's like there's certain dice I just need to become popular so that I can make the games I want to, right? So.
Fudge dice do not get the respect they deserve.
Oh, truly. I used fudge dice in my very first iteration of Slug Blaster back in 2016.
Wow. When
playing with my friend. Yeah, I used them as the... journey. Yeah, exactly. Oh, no, for sure. It's, proto Slug Blaster. But I used it as the and or the but. Like, you know, you succeed and you succeed. Yeah, so I don't know if that's even how you use them in Fate, because I haven't played Fate. But they worked great for... for what I was
check
doing.
Out the episode I did on Fate with Wendy Yu this season.
Man, yeah, that's good.
So she's amazing. So
absolutely.
There's a tendency for, like, in all the games we put on this list that have exploding dice in them that I picked up and opened, every single one of them was 300 goddamn pages long. Like, I really feel like exploding dice keep living in these enormous games, these games that are otherwise already too complicated in their resolution mechanics and in the rest of them. There's an obvious answer for why this is, which is that like people who like weird little fiddly bits just fucking can't help themselves. Here's another one, like they get on there. But like, is that just it? Do you think that there's something else to why exploding dice only live in these complicated games?
No, I think you're onto something, but then I think the caveat I would say is that like Renegade Racer, I'm looking at here, is 13 pages.
Oh, there you go.
But I know for a fact that the Renegade Racer designer, they're sort of one of those post-trad, like, experimenters, right? Yeah. Like, this sort of idea of, like, let's make these games that use the fun, crunchy mechanics we like, but then adding, you know, indie sensibility to it, right?
Yeah, so totally.
I think, in fact, I'm looking at the back of the book, and one of the reviews is a 1-star review that says not D&D compatible, which is just hilarious. So yeah, I think like, that's it. I do agree that that kind of numbers equals excitement personality trait, although those people, they can handle trad games more, right? But when those people start designing games, and if they collide with the indie sphere, then they're going to make games like Renegade Racer and cool stuff, right? But I think that's exactly it. There's people who... I often talk about this when people ask, like, what's a good role-playing game to introduce my friends to who haven't played before? And I always say, like, I don't think there's one answer. I think there's two answers. And it really depends. You have to know which kind of friend you have. Do you have a friend who likes board games, in which case I would start them with something like a dungeon crawler or something with very light role playing in it, or even something like Fog of Love, which is basically a board game, but it has these little role playing prompts occasionally in it. Or is your friend the kind of person who like was a drama kid and likes improv games, in which case I would have them play like Fiasco or something first, right?
So, or the Queen.
Yeah, exactly. And that's super reductive and simplistic, but I just think role-playing games are still this kind of weird mishmash hybrid of things, right? And the biggest, longest running ones of them tried to appeal to all those things. And I think that's part of the reason they're successful, is because they kind of appeal to lots of different player types, you know, maybe not fully satisfying any of them, but like, but you know,
but you can get them all in the same room.
Sure. Sometimes it's like, you can't get your perfect group who all like Fiasco. Right. And so I do think, like, you know, that's why it seems like this space there's a lot of arguing about what is a role-playing game and what is and what's the right way to do role-playing and all this kind of stuff, which obviously, if you take a step back, those are ridiculous questions, but I think it makes sense that we talk about it just because there are so many people play these games for so many different reasons, right? There are the people who play them for, as Grant Howe would say, press button, make number go up, right? And then there are people who play them to tell a story or to get into a character. And most people play them for a mix of all those things.
That's, process their generational trauma.
Yeah, exactly. That's right. Yeah. Marry a slime and raise a family and, you know, like all, you know. So I think we can't reduce it. Like most of us, the reason we like role-playing games is because we get to do all those things, right? Like,
yeah.
I mean, I think me and you were talking about that the other day about how some games, the mode switching you have to do can be seen as a benefit, right? For people who like to have a little break from role-playing and want to do bookkeeping, as you said, right? And then there are other people who they're like, no, keep me in the good stuff, right? So
yeah. You keep just going off on these wonderful tangents about like the philosophy of role-playing games at large and great content that I don't have a follow-up to. And then I come back with a question like,
you're trying to keep us on topic.
Tell me more about exploding dice.
No, I'm delivering my manifesto. Like, this is my only platform. Like,
this
bonus episode hidden behind a paywall is like where I like left my legacy. Yeah, no.
Yeah.
No. I think that's, I mean, just...
we'll release it in 69 years from now.
Yeah, exactly.
This is truly what I love about the show is that like I'm here like stay on topic and people are like abso-fucking-lutely not, like I'm gonna take your topic and I'm gonna talk about whatever the fuck I want.
We're like
that's the point of the show. That is
have
what
you
I
never
like,
listened to a podcast, Sam? Come
yeah,
on, I
exactly.
thought I was doing this right.
all of this stuff coming out of the tiny details, that's what exploding that's what Dice Exploder is all about anyway. But I do want to ask one last question about exploding dice, which is, if you can take a second and just imagine in your mind's eye what you think like the best game to showcase this mechanic would look like. Like if your goal as a designer was highlight the mechanic of exploding dice, what is the game that you would make?
Yeah, I think it would be about like emotionally unstable wizards or something, right? Like, and I'd want to juice it somehow where the exploding was happening more often. So
you would just only use d4s, right?
Yeah, I guess so. Or big dice pools where it's guaranteed to happen a bit. But yeah, I think chaos magic is a perfect place for it. But then I would, because we're indie, I gotta put some feelings into it. So I would connect. You know, I'd have each wizard, your school of magic would be like your emotional flaw or crutch or something, you know, like your trigger or something like that.
Yeah.
And like, I would really tie it to that so you can be in the school of jealousy or the school of rage or whatever. But then, yeah, the goal of the game would be just to create like carnage, both physical and emotional.
You'd be like on a reality TV show, right?
Oh,
it'd be like a reality TV show wizard game featuring exploding dice.
Okay, well, we need to strike this from the podcast so that we can write this, right? I think that's it.
We need to get back to fucking, what is that game even called? The Glock Knight. We need to get back to
Glock Knight. Yes.
Glock Knight should have dice exploding all over the goddamn place.
You get to use exploding dice when you use mushrooming bullets, right? Like
There's one playbook that's just like exploding dice all the time.
Yes, it's the grenade playbook.
Yeah.
That's the thing about exploding dice.
We're doing this. Oh my God, this is a Glock Knight design diary again.
Exactly.
Oh,
I do think you're right. Like, as we talked about, the name of the mechanic is so cool and in some ways is cooler than the mechanic itself. Like, evokes more like as I, you know, say about like this reality show wizards, like I'm picturing a feeling of rolling these dice. But I honestly don't know if the mechanic would even support that, or if once we start playtesting, I'd find some other kind of similar mechanic that would actually do it better. But I think it'd be a good place to start, right? And
I think if you're
making a game where you want like that lottery ticket like possibility feeling and like chaos is encouraged and a crazy thing happening is what the story is going to become about and not something that's going to derail the story, then I think that's probably where it should be used.
All right, I'm going to take us out.
Yeah.
So I mentioned this earlier. I almost read this verbatim. I'm going to read this actually verbatim from my notes now.
Okay.
So in the end, this is a niche thing that doesn't change much, but is a lot of hassle and variance and clunk for what exactly? Response, bro, it's cool. You're overthinking it. This shit rips and that's the end of it. And I've actually come around.
I'll co-sign
that. I think both of these statements are false because the first statement is just wrong. I've come around completely. Like, sprinkles are amazing. Like, adding spice, like, cut up that jalapeno and put it on your fucking ice cream. Like, let's use exploding dice. But also the second one is wrong because, like, overthinking it is what this show is about and is what brought me to that conclusion. Like, overthinking it fucking rules. Listen to Dice Exploder Season 3. Back it now. You already have if you're listening to this. Like, let's fucking go.
Yeah. That's great.
Thanks for being here, Mikey.
Yeah, of course. Thanks for having me.
Thanks, Mikey. You're the best. Mikey did this episode with me for free to support the Kickstarter campaign I did, and I could not be more grateful. Remember, he's got his own game funding right now, Two Hand Path, a solo game, roll and write dungeon crawler. Link in the show notes. You can find him on Blue Sky at Mikey Ham, or you can buy Slug Blaster, Kickflip Over a Quantum Centipede from MythWorks. That's myth.works. You can find me on all the socials at S. Dunewald, Blue Sky Preferred. Our logo was designed by Sporgory, and our theme song is Sunset Bridge by Purely Gray. There's a Dice Exploder Discord. Come on down and talk about the show. We'd love to have you. And thank you. Oh my God, what a treat to have you listening. Thank you. Talk soon.